От России там только центральный федеральный округ.
Формально Российская Федерация.
Российская Федерация может распасться так же, как и Советский Союз.
Каковы риски распада страны?
Это закончится развалом.
Территория Российской Федерации поделена на целых.
Бороться за отделение Сибири от России.
Татария, ее теперь нужно называть Татарстан.
Такой страны, как Россия, не будет.
It's the Kremlin's worst nightmare that the Russian Federation shares the fate of the Soviet Union and disintegrates. Far-fetched? Yeah, probably. But the fear appears to be honestly felt. And as calls for regional autonomy get louder and bolder, from Kaliningrad to Siberia, from Karelia to Tatarstan, Vladimir Putin's regime has moved to tighten the screws. And this is only serving to spark more resentment in the regions. Are the Kremlin's fears of federalism making its biggest fear more likely? Hello from our broadcast headquarters in Prague, and welcome to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. Joining me on the Skype line from Moscow is co-host Mark Galliotti, a professor at New York University, an expert in Russian security services, and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. Welcome back, Mark.
Hey there, Brian.
And also joining us via Skype from Staunton, Virginia, is longtime Russia watcher Paul Gobel, author of the blog Window on Eurasia. Welcome to the podcast, Paul. It's great to finally have you on.
Thank you.
Well, Russian officials love to talk about federalism as long as they're talking about Ukraine. When it comes to Russia, such talk is practically considered treasonous. Part of this is explained by Russia's long-held tradition of centralization. Part of it from a fear born in the 1990s that any loosening of Moscow's control will lead to disintegration. But there are rumblings in the regions. And Paul, I know you write about this a lot in your blog, and I've been following and relying on it for years. Where do you see the biggest fractures, the biggest rumbles? Where are the fault lines, and where might this lead?
Well, I think one needs to understand that the challenge to Moscow is Moscow itself. It is Moscow's tightening of the screws that is producing a reaction in the republics, in the non-Russian areas, and in the Russian areas as well, let's be clear, that by its drive for hyper-centralization after the loosening that took place in the 1990s, many people around the Russian Federation are convinced that unless they're able to stake out some way of protecting their own interests, Moscow will simply continue to take more and more. When the Soviet Union fell apart, and I would urge everyone to remember that no one very much expected that to happen until after it did, and then many people were unable to cope with the fact that it had after it did. The pressures that existed at that time happened primarily because Gorbachev loosened up on the republics and then tried to tighten the screws again, and people weren't prepared to take it. It wasn't the loosening that led to the falling apart. It was the loosening followed by the attempted tightening again at the end of 1990 and early 1991 that prompted Shevardnadze's resignation as foreign minister and much else. The problem, if we're going to talk about the regional challenges or republic challenges to the Russian Federation, the greatest danger to Moscow's control is Moscow itself. By trying to take back those things that the republics thought they had gotten earlier, by assuming that Chechnya was the only model, that, you know, in other words, any additional power to the republics necessarily means independence, much as Gorbachev and those around him assumed that any additional power to the Baltic countries would lead to the dismemberment of everything, and then tried to take things back. We have a Moscow that is provoking people in the regions, in Karelia, in Siberia. And I think it's interesting that it's probably stronger in the Russian areas than the non-Russian areas. We have a real problem in thinking about this because, A, we probably know less about Russia outside of Moscow than we do about outside of any of the other capitals of the Union republics that are now independent. Two, we tend to assume that the Russian Federation is Russia. The fact is, it isn't. It is a miniature Soviet Union in terms of its ethnic composition. whereas the other republics have moved in the direction of becoming nation states. That's had some problems, of course, in Georgia and Ukraine and elsewhere, but they've tried to become nation states. Many people in the West seem to think that it's all right to talk about border changes when it works to the advantage of the Russian Federation, but not the other way. And I would suggest that the current acceleration of demands for regional autonomy were provoked by what Mr. Putin did in the name of rebuilding Russia, namely the seizure of Crimea. Mm-hmm. By calling the borders into question of the 1991 border settlement, Putin has called more than just the borders of Ukraine into question. He's called many people inside the Russian Federation to think, well, if their borders are not right, and in terms, strictly ethnographic terms, the borders of 1991 were not perfect, then maybe we should explore things here. So I think this is less, just as I believe the Soviet Union fell apart, less because of the drive of the non-Russians than because of the effort of Gorbachev in at the end of 90 and early 91 to retake power at the center. So too, I believe that the challenges to the center that we talk about are themselves the product of what Moscow is, and especially the Kremlin, is doing.
Well, you've certainly given us a lot to chew on there, Paul. And you've written about, I mean, there's certain areas, and I know this, and I got to give credit where credit's due, because I read your blog every day. But Karelia, Kaliningrad, Siberia seem to be the three areas that keep coming up again and again and again. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about what's going on in each of those, and if maybe there are others that I'm missing here.
Well, I think there are several reasons that I write as much as I do about Karelia. For one thing, it has a very active and lively local press still, despite the best efforts of Putin and the governor to close it down. Second, it is closely intended by the Finns and the Estonians as to what's going on, so there's additional information. Third, several of Russia's most profound regionalist thinkers are from Karelia or live in Karelia and talk about these things. So Karelia is an easier place to study. Kaliningrad is a permanent problem. It's non-contiguous. There's a problem of supplying it without. You have to go through somebody else's territory if you're from the Materik, the mainland of Russia. And it's there was a Baltic Republic Party there earlier. It doesn't really exist anymore. But there are rumblings under the surface, and the economic problems that Russia is experiencing now have only led people in Kaliningrad to look ever more to the EU, to have a special relationship for their oblast with the European Union, and that means with Poland and Lithuania in the first instance. And that leads people to say, well, why are we not, as used to be said, the fourth Baltic Republic? Mm-hmm. From my point of view, the most interesting place is Siberia, which is Siberia and the Far East. And we use Siberia informally to mean everything east of the Urals. That's not quite true. But most of the Sibdiaki think the same way. They see this as an enormous area that has been exploited by Moscow, that 90 to 95% of the wealth that is extracted from Siberian lands goes off to Moscow and never comes back. They see a population that is declining. They see the non-Russians in the area growing relative to Russians because of Russian out-migration and because of higher birth rates and lower death rates among the non-Russians in Siberia and the Far East. And they see the rise of China as being one that Moscow seems to treat Siberia as if it can be just simply a way to make money. Whereas if you're a Siberian in Irkutsk or in Khabarovsk, or any of the other places in the area, you've got to ask yourself, what kind of a country will we be living in if Moscow, in effect, sells us out to China in the name of making money for itself? And those are driving a lot of people to ask questions about the relationship. I don't think we should be talking right now about a sort of Soviet model of disintegration. I think in the sense of, are we about to see the Russian Federation in 15 or 20 pieces? I think what we're seeing is a situation where Moscow is creating a disaster for itself that's going to be very difficult to pull back from. And how you manage that is going to determine what parts will come off. I have no doubt that the borders of the Russian Federation 5 to 10 years from now will be very different than they are today. And I give advice to my students when I teach. The only piece of good advice I can give you is don't buy any maps. Buy stock in companies that print maps and you'll make money because they're going to change.
Mark, I know we have our discussions off mic about this topic. You're skeptical about the idea of the Russia is disintegrating thesis. What are your thoughts on this?
Yeah, I mean, I think that it is clear that there is a rise in tensions, but, and this may be tempting fate, given precisely that we didn't predict the collapse of the Soviet Union. I don't see the Russian Federation breaking up or even that its borders getting nibbled at. And to an extent, I don't really feel that. I'm certainly not coming across a lot of sense that the Crimean annexation opened up the border question. But that said, I would absolutely agree that we are seeing growing tensions precisely because, from the region's point of view, they feel themselves squeezed by the center. They feel, on the one hand, that they are still being held to the kind of sort of demands that really sort of came down from the 2012 May decrees, in which the federal government set a whole series of exceedingly ambitious targets for them. But at the same time, they're finding themselves facing a sort of a triple-pronged financial crisis: lower federal subsidies, lower personal income tax revenues, lower corporate tax revenues. And this is why there's, what, about $105 billion of regional debt. Of the 83 sort of constituent elements, 20 of them are frankly effectively bankrupt, according to the Higher School of Economics. About another 40 or more are pretty close to default. But in this context, I mean, I think when they talk about autonomy, I don't think this means autonomy any more than Ramzan Kadyrov, when he talks about loyalty, he means loyalty. Instead, I think this is more a kind of a way of putting down a marker to the center, saying this is not going to work. Because again, this is, and I know we'll be talking in the second part about, as it were, how politics is coded even within an authoritarian regime. But I think it's more that they're actually saying that, you know, this is not something we can do. And I think what we're really seeing, in my opinion, is regions, and perhaps most importantly regional elites, beginning to move into survivalist mode, which again is really what they did in the 1990s. It's that sense of Moscow is the problem. In this case, Paul is absolutely right. Moscow is the problem. We're not going to challenge Moscow, A, because we don't necessarily want to try and break free. And anyway, most of these states, most of these regions would not work, even if they were blocks, regional blocks. But and in any way, also, Moscow still has a strong arm. But instead, it's basically how can we politic, maneuver, and if need be, cheat in order to preserve our interests rather than simply be subordinated to the interests of Putin's state and his essentially state-led agenda.
So I would agree. Go ahead, Paul.
I would agree that for most of these people, the strategy that you describe is exactly what's going on. I would differ only in this, and in two respects. The first is, when you put down a marker of what you're not going to tolerate and it is ignored, that has consequences. And some of those elites will simply buckle because they don't have a lot of choice. The other thing it does, by having officials use this language, talking about defending our region, to talk about our region's needs, has consequences much as the language that was used just before the wild 90s, that was used at the end of the 80s, by a whole bunch of regional Union Republic elites who wanted to get more out of Moscow and thought this was a great way to do it, but weren't really interested in independence. And then at the end of the day, they had nowhere to go and things came apart. I mean, one of the things that I think about every day is that the arguments we're hearing today, be they the relative power of Moscow and the regions, the possibility of a nuclear Yugoslavia, are exactly the same arguments we heard in 1989, 90, and 91 as to why it was unthinkable that the USSR could come apart. It was unthinkable. I will tell you that in my own view at the time, I felt very strongly that it was in Moscow's interest to find a way to get the three Baltic countries out of that, out of the USSR as quickly as possible, because as long as they were in, there were three places that really didn't want to be. The other 12, the drive for independence, not so much. And the fact that Moscow had such disproportionate power in 1991 relative to the Union republics, and I would argue it was greater, the disproportion was greater than Moscow's power vis-a-vis some of the larger, at least collective regions. I keep asking myself, well, why is it that it happened in 91 that this very powerful center managed to put itself in a position by its own actions that led people to draw the conclusion that they had nowhere else to go? And I wonder whether I agree with you perfectly, completely, that the language that 95% of the regional leaders are using is being used exactly as you describe. But I think that some people are reading it in more extravagant ways, and I think the longer it goes on, that Moscow is unable to redress the imbalance that it itself has created, the more people are going to listen to those who say some other solution needs to be. I believe that federalism, real federalism, which people in Moscow are so confident will save the unity of Ukraine, could save the unity of the Russian Federation. But a denial of federalism, which is what we see on offer, and the Russian Federation is called a federation. Well, you can call anything you like a federation, but that doesn't make it so. What the central government has done is to violate every principle of federalism going, violate every federal provision of the 1993 Constitution. And then they're surprised that people are angry, and they just bleat about the Russian Federation, the successor to the RSFSR, being Russia. I've yet to meet a Russian, yet to meet in my 40-some years in this business, who thinks that the borders of the RSFSR, which is to say the borders of the Russian Federation, are the proper borders of Russia. Some think, many think, that they're too small, and some think they're too large. But I don't know anyone who says, when I think of Russia, what I think of is the RSFSR. We forget quite often that the RSFSR was drawn up by Stalin in a fundamentally different way than all the other Union republics. He drew the borders of all the other Union republics first, and what was left was the RSFSR, not the other way around. And that creates a huge set of problems, which one could detail in at great length.
Mark, it looked. I
think just to sort of follow on from that, there's a difference between saying this is how I would draw the boundaries of my state if I had a blank sheet of paper now. There's another one actually, uncorking the whole issue of borders and so forth. But if we play this sort of parallel with 1990 and above all 1991, I mean, just make a couple of points. I mean, one is that, yes, indeed, Gorbachev was looking towards creating a more genuine federal structure when he finally went to his Union Treaty, which is, after all, what triggered the August coup. And it's the August coup that in many ways shattered any real prospects of being able to save this state, because it empowered Yeltsin to actually say, no, we're not going to have this. And, of course, there could be no union without Russia. Now, it's harder to see any autonomous area which actually could play the same kind of role. After the August coup, Yeltsin could challenge Moscow, Gorbachev's Moscow, and say basically, nope, all bets are off. We said we'd sign this, we're not going to sign this now. And he could get away with it. But on the other hand, here and now, I mean, unless there's some dramatic shift, no one can really openly challenge Moscow. Whatever else, Moscow still has the capacity to reach in. It still has its security structures. There had been years in which the central state represented by Gorbachev had actually lost the wholehearted support of the security apparatus in a way that, although there's not perfection of unity in Moscow, but nonetheless, I think it is clear that if anything, Putin still has, as the, sort of the ultimate backstop of his power base, the majority of the Siloviki. I think I'd be cautious of sort of assuming parallels. And I think when it comes down to it, I think that this is still a system which is dominated by elites. And of course, mass politics, if it ever, you know, however it emerges and however it expresses itself, matters to the elites. But still, it's the elites. It's very hard to see elites whose balance of interests is actually in favor of outright challenging the unity of the state. They may well like the idea. They may well want to renegotiate. And to be honest, I think there is within acceptable within the etiquette of Russian politics to be able to say a bit of, I'm protecting the interests of my region. You know, I think the same way as, you know, I mean, one sees in some ways the fake regional politics represented also on a local city level. You know, it's just part of the, to use the, you know, we can't have an episode of Power Vertical without mentioning dramaturgia. But again, actually, to say that they would definitely really mean it, that's not something I'm seeing. Yeah, it may well emerge. And particularly, sorry, last point, particularly if it's mishandled. Again, to go back to Paul's point about that, you know, ultimately Moscow is sort of the crucial problem here. Moscow has every opportunity to mess this up. That is going to be when it really
never underestimate their ability to do that. But there's another thing I would add here, and bring Paul in, is there is a glue holding the Russian Federation together, and that is, Paul, you correctly pointed out, it's the Russian Federation is kind of like a mini Soviet Union, except one thing: it's 89% ethnic Russian.
And it's not 89%. No one says 89%. The most anyone claims is 80% now. And that number is, if you read the ethnographers and demographers, almost certainly exaggerated by 5 or 6% because of census falsifications in 2002 and 2010. I just wanted to make, if I can make two interventions, sure. I'll follow you.
Well, the point I wanted to make, though, is even if it's 75%, still, that's a little bit greater glue, because in the point I wanted to make is that with the breakup of the Soviet Union, you had the ethnic factor in the Union republics. I mean, that was a very powerful driving force. And you don't, with the exception of Tatarstan, the North Caucasus and elsewhere, you don't really have that in Russia to the same extent. Or maybe, Paul, you know a lot, you've forgotten more about this than I'll ever know, so I'll defer to you. But isn't that a countervailing force here?
You're adding to my list of comments. The first is this. I would argue that elites mattered in 91, just as much they matter now, and I would argue the nomenklatura was tougher there than now. Ethnicity is the way we started interpreting 91. I think it had a lot more to do with national elites trying to protect themselves and their own interest, and that goes for the Russian Federation too. Yes, they played the ethnic card, but it was not the only thing on the table. Ethnicity is something you can play. The danger in the Russian Federation and the place they'll make the biggest mistake is if they go to try to make Russia a, quote, Russian nation state, because if they do that, they will alienate the 25% of the population that isn't Russian in major ways. Second point, I think it's important to remember that it wasn't just the coup that caused a problem, and it wasn't the notion that anyone was going to sign the Union Treaty. Gorbachev, after letting things slide, made a real turn to the right to try to control things at the end of 90 and early 91. Let's not forget, I mean, Shevardnadze resigned over what he saw as the coming of a dictatorship. And I would argue that leads straight to August 19, the notion that Gorbachev was, you know, moving toward genuine federalism and somehow these evil people in the KGB, that's the standard line. That simply isn't the full story. I think it's fundamentally flawed, but it's certainly not the full story. Third point I would make is that I'm not predicting anything coming apart at any particular time. I think predictions are really problematic. I know how few people thought the Soviet Union was going to fall apart on December 23rd, 1991. I know that in my country, the flag of the Soviet Union was kept up 7 days after the Soviet Union had ceased to exist in the Department of State. There are a lot of people who had real problems with the fact that change happens. I completely agree that most of the time elites are able to run things. But I think it's often true that the Prince Andreys sometimes have to cope with the Platon Karatayevs, and that the Platon Karatayevs may matter more. And I think that we have overemphasized, because the Russians have insisted on it, and because 99 and 4,400% of Western Russian specialists are in fact Moscow specialists, about just how unified this thing called the Ruskaya Nacija is, the Russian nation. I mean, for all kinds of reasons that everyone in this group knows, Russian identity is a much more problematic thing than, let us say, Estonian identity or Uzbek identity. It was suppressed. It was played with, suppressed in many ways by the Tsarist regime, played with in a Faustian bargain in the Soviet times, and I think it's a lot less integral. My great hope for the future of Russia is that one part of Russia that I would like to see revived is Novgorod Veliki. I mean, in the 15th century, Novgorod Veliki was more democratic in terms of participation than the city of London. Novgorod was the democratic tradition that Russia could have developed in until the agents of the Horde, otherwise known as Muscovy, came in and killed everyone and suppressed it. The problem is there are many Russias, that doesn't mean Ukraine and Belarus are Russia. They're not, but there are many Russias, and I think those identities are more fluid than certainly many in Moscow believe, and I would suggest the percentage of people in the West believe as well. Just as I remember being told, well, people are Soviet. They will never leave the USSR, and there's the KGB, and they have huge numbers of nuclear weapons, and they like being a superpower. And guess what? In a matter of days, the entire edifice came apart. Will that happen again? I don't know. All I'm saying is that the assumption that it won't is leading Moscow to behave in ways that are counterproductive from Moscow's own interests, if indeed it wants its country in these borders. Because if it continues to act as if it can be hyper-centralist, no matter what, it will be its own gravedigger, and there will be challenges regional, and I think they will be more Russian regional than the North Caucasus. If Moscow had let the entire North Caucasus go, it would have lost about 2% of its population and maybe a little over 2% of its area. That might not be such a big tragedy. But if it loses Siberia and if it loses the Middle Volga, Tatarstan and its allies in Idel-Ural, that's another thing altogether. And my fear is that this time around, the Russian government has convinced itself that it can fight and win, just like the Serbs thought they could fight and keep Yugoslavia in a peace. And I think there's a great danger, not of a nuclear Yugoslavia, but of a violent set of convulsions that could go off in very, very dangerous and bad ways. I very much hope Moscow will come to its senses after Putin and move toward a more genuine power-sharing arrangement with the regions and the republics, that we'll see a real federation in Russia, not the fake one on offer now. Because if we don't, over time, the regional and ethnic divisions and the divisions within the Russian people will, I believe, provide the basis for forces that will tear it apart. And that worries me, because I think if it happens now, the Russian government has been convinced, and often with invoking Western analysis and Western government opinion, that it has so many resources that it can ignore the regions, that it can suppress them, and that it do so at no cost and no risk. My argument is there are costs and there are risks. Not that it's going to happen tomorrow, but I suspect that one could draw a number of scenarios where it would happen within the next 5 to 10 years. And that doesn't mean it's going to be over then. I think we're seeing a process of imperial devolution that began in 1901. And this is just the latest. I mean, after it seized the last part of Afghanistan in 1901, the Russian state has been in decline most of that period. It lost a lot in 1917. It lost more in 1991. And if it keeps it up, my guess is it will lose even more. And I think there are lots of Russians who are afraid of that. And tragically, I think there's a man in the Kremlin who thinks that no matter what he does, these borders will be maintained. And therefore, he will if not expanded, and therefore he is going to do things that's going to make it even worse.
Well, let's take a look at this from the other from kind of the other side of the telescope, so to speak. Paul, I think you correctly pointed out that true federalism would be the best thing for Russia. We tend to look at the 90s. Everything's relative, of course. We tend to look at the 90s as this golden age of federalism.
I
find it hard to believe anyone can see the 90s as a golden year of anything other than a few people's self-enrichment.
As I said, everything is relative. the 90s relative today. There was more federalism in the 90s. I worked as a correspondent in Russia in the 90s, and what it was, it wasn't federalism. It was 89 little Soviet unions, basically. There were 89 subjects to the Russian Federation then, and basically you had nominal democracy at the top and nominal pluralism at the top, but you had tight repression at the regional level in a lot of places. Mm-hmm. Vladivostok, St. Petersburg, where I worked out of. In the 90s, there was a feeling that federalism didn't work. It just created these 89 little quasi-autonomous criminal states, so to speak. Why can't Russia federalize? What is the problem? Paul, in your blog, you suggested it's this kind of Moscow has to shed the Muscovy yoke, just like Germany shed the Prussian yoke after the Second World War. What is it that keeps Moscow from federalizing effectively?
The first thing that needs to be said is that federal systems are rare. There are fewer self-described federations in the world than there are monarchies. There are 26 monarchies in the world, and there are 23 federations. Federations are hard to organize, and they're rare. Just because the United States has one, we assume that it is somehow natural and universal. Putting together a federation when you've never had one requires constitutional, legal, social agreement on who does what and who doesn't do certain things. And that's a very, very hard thing to bring into any political system that doesn't have that kind of experience.
So Russia needs the Commerce Clause.
Well, Russia needs a lot of things. We'll start Marbury versus Madison and a few other things. But the idea, I personally think that the Russian Federation came to be called the Russian Federation by a conjunction of two things. It was a contraction of the RSFSR, which had the word federated in it, and Western notions that somehow a federal system, if you declared it, would come into existence. The optimism of the West misplaced as usual. Building a federal, I think what you had in the 90s was chaos.
Right.
I think you had some places where the regions were run as you suggest, as little Stalins, as little autocracies. You had others where it was a much more democratic and participatory system. You had regions that wanted to cooperate with Moscow, and you had regions that were looking for a way out. You had regions that were trying to amalgamate from below, lest they be amalgamated from above. It was a very chaotic system. I would share Mark's view. I wouldn't call it the golden age of federalism. And I think the problem is, and you've put your finger on it, that most Russians think that that was the golden age of federalism. And that provides a resource, a political resource, for Vladimir Putin and his people to oppose genuine federalism. The problem is what they had in the 90s wasn't federalism. It was chaos. And that's why Putin came to power, because he was elected to end the chaos. The problem now, however, I think, and this is what worries me, is that he believes he can keep centralizing way beyond anything people were dreaming of in the coup plotters in August of 91 and get away with it. My suspicions is that he's going to find out he's wrong. That the history of that country and of other countries suggests that hyper-centralization can lead to chaos and collapse Federalism, on the other hand, being messy, tends to muddle along. I think that trying to be neat, clean, and make it all the decision of one man will mean that that one man will not make decisions for a lot of people in the future.
Mark, you've been silent for far too long for my taste, and I see you're writing furiously. And whenever Mark is writing furiously, I know wisdom is going to come out of his mouth. So let's hear it.
Well, I don't know about that. I mean, absolutely. Let's just start from, if you look at the 1990s, that was not a period of federalism. That was a period of a weak center. Despite the sort of the notional ideas of how the state was structured, in practice, it was basically being built by a kind of constant competition between localities and centers. It just happened to be a period in which actually the center was relatively weak. But yeah, I think if we look at why there is no scope for federalism in today's Russia, and again, ideally, if we had a blank sheet of paper, it makes a lot of sense. But there's the historical dimension, as you've mentioned. The fact is that a non-federal, you know, sort of a centralized structure is more able to focus resources. Because the point is, of federalism, you know, you actually have to consider the views, the interests, the needs of all the various regions. At the moment, there is no way that Russia can be anything like the great power to which at least some people believe it needs to be or ought to be, and at the same time look after the interests of all Russians. That's the trade-off. It's basically you guys all have to pay for the Navy, for the subsidies for the Chechnya, for whatever else that's sort of a part of Russia's great power dream. Because, third point, federalism means flows of wealth. It would mean exactly that, you know, let's take Siberia, let's take these regions. I mean, at the moment, they are basically bankrolling the rest of the country. Well, in a federalist structure, they would say, actually, come to think of it, this isn't quite equitable. Yeah, I mean, you know, but there will be these whole separate issues. I mean, at the moment, Moscow, which is this tremendously lively and vibrant city, but in many ways it is that because it does so by sucking the blood from the rest of European Russia. Well, at what point does Yakutia say, come to think of it, no, we want to have our own Moscow, thank you very much indeed. But really, in some ways, all of these are irrelevant, because the most fundamental reason why there is no federalism is because it means a central government willing to give up a lot of authority. You use America as an example. On the one hand, obviously, the federal government has quite a lot of powers in certain areas. In other areas, it is completely stymied by the political system.
And thank God for that.
It will need to be, federalism can only come as part of a much, much wider transition of power. And actually, it'll have to be either that regions can force a political transition on a center, which frankly I don't think will be a Putin center, but maybe in an interregnal era, or else a very forward-looking center that actually seeks to devolve power outwards. But that happens very, very rarely. But in that respect, federalism is going to be part of some wider renegotiations of power. I personally don't see a sort of a violent Yugoslav scenario emerging, but I do see the potential for some very hard-nosed and quite sort of tough political and economic negotiations taking place in the future, which might well lead, and it is one of the ways in which actually this huge sprawling state could indeed survive, which might well lead to a more federal structure. But I think it's going to be a piecemeal process.
I think it's going to take a long time, or it could happen overnight, and I don't know. I think one of the issues here is this. There are two ways of looking at politics. There is the top-down approach, which emphasizes what the elites want and how they act. And there's the bottom-up, which says there's a population out there that's affected, that elites may play to or not play to. And the question is, what's the balance between those two? Historically in Russia, the elites have been everything and the people have been nothing. I'm not sure, and I very much hope that it will not be the case, that will remain forever and ever. As people get more used to having access to certain things, as they become middle class, to use that argument if you like, they will want more things. And the idea that they can be bought off with bread and circuses, Sochi Olympics, and annexations of Crimea forever and ever, I think is betting against history. Do I think that's exactly what Vladimir Putin is doing? Do I think that's exactly how he sees the situation? Yes, because he is totally contemptuous of the idea that people, as opposed to elites, should make decisions for themselves. I think he is so profoundly wrong on that that he is going to cause no end of trouble for Russia, not just with the West, but for itself. When a country starts burning food at the border, when it has hungry people in its own institutions, I think it's very difficult to explain that to the average Russian, who, as we are told routinely by Kremlin propagandists, at base is concerned first and foremost with justice. I think it gets really hard, and I think Mr. Putin's regime is making a lot of mistakes, and I think it will continue to make mistakes as long as it assumes that it can get away with anything. And I suspect that the notion that it can get away with anything will keep it in power for some time, but that at the end of the day, there will be a crash, and that we will have chaos. And out of that, we may either have yet another authoritarian central regime celebrated by all kinds of people who want to go there and make money or make careers, or it will disintegrate. Mm-hmm. And my guess is that the balance between those two prospects in this century is not nearly as one-sided as most people assume. And since I am someone who's always looked at politics bottom-up rather than top-down, who's always been much more concerned with the people than the police, and as someone who's always believed that Mao was wrong, power doesn't come out of the barrel of the gun. Power comes out of the guy who's going to pull the trigger or not. And I think we need to pay a lot more attention to who's going to pull the trigger than we do to who has the gun. And that's not, quite frankly, the way in which most of the interpretation that's done of Russia today, either in Moscow or the West, is done. I'm simply trying to register my objections in the minutes, having registered my objections in the minutes in the past, when I very much hoped that the Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania would get out quickly so that the demise of the rest of it could take place in a more orderly fashion. But Gorbachev wouldn't let the bolts go, and as a result, he lost everything. And I think that Vladimir Putin is going to be playing the same role. I think if we could return to this conversation in 50 years, I think we very likely would recall that Vladimir Putin had assumed his proper place in Russian history, along with Nicholas II and Mikhail Gorbachev, as one of the three greatest destroyers of the Russian state.
Well, your objections, Paul, are duly noted in the minutes, and in a few moments, we will shift gears and take a look at the flurry of leaks connected to the investigation into Boris Nemtsov's assassination and discuss what they show us about how the Russian elite communicates with each other in a restrictive system. I'd like to remind you, you're listening to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFRL. Joining me on the Skype line from Moscow is co-host Mark Galeotti, a professor at New York University and expert on Russia's security services and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. And joining us via Skype from Staunton, Virginia is longtime Russia watcher Paul Goebel, author of the blog Window on Eurasia. I'd also like to remind you, you could subscribe to the Power Vertical Podcast on iTunes. You could read the Power Vertical blog and watch the Daily Vertical at rfrl.org, and you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical.
Расследование убийства Бориса Немцова.
В расследовании появились новые детали.
Следствие, у каждого из участников была своя задача.
И конкретно рассматривает несколько версий преступления, включая
за убийство Бориса Немцова подключены лучшие криминалисты.
Действовали холоднокровные профессионалы.
In the half year since Boris Nemtsov was assassinated, we have learned a lot. We've learned that Zohar Dadayev was the trigger man. We've been led to believe that the hit was ordered by Ruslan Geremeyev, deputy commander of Chechnya's Battalion Sever. And it's been implied that the ultimate mastermind was Chechen leader Ramzan Kadyrov or his close ally and cousin Adam Delimkhanov. And as you wrote in an insightful piece this week, Mark, we know this, or we think we know it, not because of a court case, but because of a steady flow of strategic leaks to the media. Mark, you argue that the fact that Russia's traditionally tight-lipped law enforcement system is leaking from every seam tells us a lot about how the political process works in Russia. You called it pluralism by leak. Elaborate, please.
Surely. Well, on the one hand, it's worth mentioning that at least some of the leaks seem to have just simply been from frustrated investigators. And in some ways, this sort of feeds back to Paul's point from before the break, that we have to bear in mind the human factor, the individuals concerned at the bottom of the system, rather than just purely the Vlasti, the powerful interests at the top. But putting that to one side, yeah, it seems clear that this is a way in which the various elements of the security apparatus, all of whom share a desire, you know, not just an axe to grind, but a desire to plant that axe in Ramzan Kadyrov, given half the chance, to keep the story on the boil. Because if you look at the leaks, it's interesting that they don't tend to be actually necessarily presenting any new information. They'd really just packaging the other stuff. And a certain number of them come in media outlets that, let us say, have been in the past thought to have been quite close to the security agencies. So really, they just want to keep the story there, keep the story live. And I think they're doing so not because they reckon that actually they can topple Kadyrov in the imminent future. Putin seems still to believe that he needs Kadyrov. But instead to just slowly shift the nature of the debate, just to make the point that Kadyrov is a problem and at some point something will have to be done about it. And I think this actually reflects a much wider pattern. In many ways, precisely because of the way that policymaking has now become abstracted to a small and essentially opaque group of people, this is not just even a power vertical, but a very, very small tip of the power vertical. And a frustration, and I find this, it's interesting here in Moscow, you know, from a variety of different agencies, you know, whether it's foreign ministry or the defense ministry or the police or whatever, the feeling that they actually have very little traction these days on the policy process, that they are very much treated as just executives, that their job is to do what they're told, rather than that they actually have any, even that their bosses have any real say in the political process. So in that kind of environment in which you have no alternative channels to advocate policies, present your notion of the world, in a way, all you can do is by throwing it into the kind of debates that then, you know, the other members of the elite read or listen to and get things discussed. Because, I mean, we see it in a variety of ways. I mean, the Nemtsov case, it's very much Kadyrov is a problem. Ultimately, we're going to have to do something about it. At the St. Petersburg Economic Forum, you had a lot of entrepreneurs, business people, talking about, you know, basically the foolish laws that were being presented by the Duma. Now, we know full well that the Duma, for all its craziness, is not an independent body. So actually, when you're criticizing the laws that the Duma is putting forward, this is the coded way of actually basically saying the government. We see it in the way the military, a lot of the discussions they have about how the USA and NATO uses hybrid war and sort of non-military ways of destabilizing countries. They're actually talking about how they have planned to do so and are currently demonstrating it in Ukraine. So there's a variety of ways in which people can't come out and actually simply say, we think this is the policy. We think we should do something alternative. You've already raised, in previous, I think it's Daily Verticals, about the discussion over what to do in the Donbass. Do you need another Belarus or whatever? You know, these are just simply the ways in which actually an elite that is feeling worried about the situation, frustrated about its inability to have, as it were, domestic internal channels through which to articulate policy, is just trying to get ideas out there. And in a way, almost seeing if something catches the eye of the Tsar or one of the Tsar's closest boyars.
No, you mentioned the St. Petersburg Economic Forum. There was also a very interesting thing that came out of there in some of the commentaries and press reports that afterwards about Kazakhstan. This very interesting debate about Nazarbayev's economic reforms and how he was going to turn Kazakhstan into another Singapore, and that Kazakhstan was going to surpass Russia in its economic development because of this. And this was being put out by people like Gerben Greff. You know, in the press, and it was really a discussion about Russia as much as it was about Kazakhstan. Paul, you probably read the Russian media more than is good for anybody's sanity. And this phenomenon is not limited to the Nemtsov investigation, as Mark noted. What are some of the things you've noticed about how this kind of form of communication goes on and signaling and coding goes on in the media?
Well, just as a preliminary, I would say that this kind of communication happens in all political systems because most middle-level officials are very much aware that an op-ed in the New York Times will be read by senior officials more than their memo is likely to be, and so they will do it, and it happens all the time. In the Russian case, I see this kind of, if you can use the term now, Aesopian language. In other words, we can't talk about one thing, so we talk about another. The problem, of course, is, and this is where I get interested in it, it's very appropriate now to talk about federalization of Ukraine. It's very appropriate to talk about federalization of Ukraine. You're encouraged to talk about how important it is that Ukraine federalize. And you're supposed to marshal all the arguments why that is. And there are a lot of people who are saying, let's marshal all those arguments. And I don't think all of them are talking about Ukraine. And I think that this is another example when hypercentralization, not only is the population excluded, but the elites are excluded. And so what happens is the elites start saying things that have consequences for not maybe their first intended audience, but a second audience that are very different than anyone wants. I don't think Vladimir Putin really would like anyone to write an article in Sklyad that said federalism is good for Russia.
Right.
You know, if it's good for Ukraine, it's good for Russia. But if Sklyad chooses to write an article saying federalization of Ukraine is a great idea, I think an awful lot of people are saying, well, maybe it should be a good idea for us. And I would say another example has to do with the use of force. People are in the North Caucasus. People are talking about how effective force was in ending the Chechen war and bringing to power Ramzan Kadyrov. And now they're saying, but do we want the same thing to happen in Dagestan? The FSB in the last 2 weeks has launched a major sweep trying to destroy the clans connected to three of the four largest ethnic groups there in the hopes that they can restore Dagestan to Russia's legal field. Exactly the same language that Vladimir Vladimirovich was using in 2000 about why going back into Chechnya. Again, an argument that has one set of meanings if you look at it from Moscow's perspective and another set of meanings when it's elsewhere. So I completely share your view that this is an increasingly important form of communication. What I wonder is whether they're able to keep everything restricted. It was once said of Secretary James Baker that he could run for president if he was allowed to speak to the American people on background. In a certain sense, some of these Russian officials would do very well by the arguments they're making if they were speaking on background. But once they're linked to these ideas and once those ideas go out in this public forum, it seems to me they have larger impacts. They have a larger audience than just the one they intended for. And it's those additional or alternative audiences that seem to me that will play an important role in this. I think the other thing I guess I believe is that we're in August. August is the silly season.
Right.
And we see a lot of things in the media that and that's true in the United States as well as anywhere else, because it's hard. People are on vacation and the news process slows down. It'll be interesting. What will be very interesting, Mark, is to see whether this kind of intra-elite communication takes off or pulls back after the start of the school year and a return to business as usual.
Mark, what about the notion that this kind of backfires? The intended message isn't always the message that's received.
I mean, in fairness, I'm not really getting a sense that there is that kind of wide, certainly at this stage, that wider bleed out that, in fact, people are sort of, most people are not that interested. And the kind of, again, what's the point, I think? People do not actually feel connected with the power system. And I think for most, the answer is therefore not to sort of try and create alternatives and such like, but just simply to, at the moment, go to the dacha, perhaps, or, you know, whatever else. But I think it's more that actually most people have, to a considerable extent, opted out. But I certainly feel that this is not just an August phenomenon. I mean, this is something that we have seen sort of emerging, and really, you know, particularly in this most recent Putin term, because he has definitely come back as a different Putin, one who listens to and talks to far, far fewer people. But it very much, I think, again, speaks to a deep dysfunctionality within the political system. And one that it's actually really, for me, even just sort of speculating with a blank sheet of paper, it's very hard to see how the current Putin regime comes through that. You have a regime which is willfully cutting itself off from inputs. And whether that's what, going back to our sort of first discussion, whether that's what federal elites or federal peoples and groups are saying, or whether that's a lot its own officials are saying or whatever. Now, not only does it mean that actually often you get bad policy being made at the center, or policy being based on completely unrealistic precepts, whether it's because, oh, the BRICS and China are going to be our sort of new basis of power, who needs the West, or whether it's that, oh, well, surely the oil price is going to perk up any day now.
It's been below 50 for 3 days.
Exactly. I mean, there's been so many issues of clearly sort of bad policymaking. But it's not just simply bad policies being made from the center and applied. It's actually that, therefore, I think you increasingly have government structures themselves that are having trouble operating. Because they don't really know what policy is going to be tomorrow. They only have a sense of what it is today. And in some ways, they're having to therefore hedge their bets. They're having to guess. And in some cases, they are getting trapped. I mean, one can just look at the foreign ministry. The number of times that Lavrov, who's after all, in many ways, the consummate diplomat, comes out with statements and then is almost immediately cut off at the knees by something that comes from the power vertex and so forth. This is not carefully managed choreography. This is just clumsy and dysfunctional political system at work.
I agree with that. I would say that one of the things we need to return to is a comparison of the two images of high Stalinism in Arthur Koestler's Darkness and Noon versus the case of Comrade Tulayev by Victor Serge. The Koestler version is the preferred Western and increasingly the preferred Russian version of reality, which that this was all a rational thing that was done and orders were given and things happened. Serge's image was the center gave orders, and by the time they had gone through three or four steps, people were doing all kinds of things, often quite different than those which the originators of those orders intended, all their power notwithstanding. And I think that what you're saying about the fact that there isn't a clear agenda, that there isn't policy formation and policy implementation phases are so cluttered and messy that people don't know where to go, is allowing some people, or is freezing some people, but it's leading others to go out and try things on their own, sometimes more outrageous than anything anyone in the Kremlin could have dreamed of, sometimes in directions that respond to local conditions that may have consequences very different than those intended. I would argue that what's going on with the Petrozavodsk mayor and the
effort... Right, which is an interesting thing to watch.
Very interesting case, has probably more to do with Hudayanin's view of what he can now get away with, given how things are going, than any decision being made in the presidential administration in Moscow. I think Hudayanin is the problem there, not so much Moscow, although Moscow holds responsibility because it appointed him. But I think that the kind of political disarray you describe in the elites, the breakdown of communication links, points to even more trouble ahead in terms of the domestic arrangements in the Russian Federation. All kinds of world political triumphs, if they ever happen, notwithstanding.
Well, let's bring this all around full circle as we're coming up to the end here, because in the first half we talked about, the first three quarters, I guess, as it turns out, we talked about the potential disintegration of the regions from the center. What we seem to be talking about here in the second segment is the disintegration of the center itself. No?
I completely agree. I believe that the Soviet Union disintegrated because the center disintegrated. Uh-huh. I believe that the I believe that everyone ought to go back and reread a book that was published in Munich in 1961 by a man named Kurganov, I.A. Kurganov, called The Nations of the USSR and the Russian Question. And in that book, he said that what the non-Russians will do will be driven by how the Russians react. If the non-Russians do things, and if the Russians react in one way, there are possibilities for a way forward that is somewhat stable. If, on the other hand, the center, the Russia, if you will, the imperial center, screws up because it's not listening or because it believes its own propaganda, then the situation can get out of hand all too quickly. And I think it is the disarray in Moscow that has more to do with the future of the borders of the Russian Federation than anything anyone in the borderlands is currently thinking about in a serious way.
Mark, last word to you. Are we seeing a disintegration in the center right now? Is Paul right? This kind of mirrors what we saw in the center in 1991.
I don't really want to draw the parallels with 1991.
Well, but, okay,
I
mean, forget the parallels with 1991. Are we seeing a disintegration of the center?
No, I mean, I think there's a difference. We need to be clear that there's a difference, in my opinion at least, between dysfunction and disintegration. I don't think we're at disintegration yet. Two things, really. One is that instead you actually have a whole array of structures which actually can do their jobs. The problem is not they are incapable of doing their jobs. The problem is in some ways that they're not being used properly. They don't really know how to be used. They don't really know what their jobs are in a way from day to day. And therefore, they can't be being used effectively. But I think the core, the sinews of the state are still far, far more effective than in historical parallels we might draw. but the second point I'd make is again, I think we need to realize that the issue that the regional factor is not a nice straightforward one of regions straining at the leash to go one way and the center dragging them the other way. I mean, in some cases, actually, the regions or regional elites may well be rather more corrupt, rather more hard-nosed or whatever than actually Moscow might like them. Again, for me, the classic example is Nizhny Novgorod, which has become infamous of late for a whole series, going after American academics, PhD student being dragged out of the archives and accused of being a spy on the most ludicrous of reasons. Either Nizhny Novgorod elite as a whole or someone there has clearly decided that their shtick, the thing that's going to make them noticeable, is to be the most hard-nosed SOB in Russia. And in a way, so what they're actually doing is taking permissions and taking it in a very different way. Now, I think that is highly problematic for the center. Again, it leads to an incoherence in policy, and it leads to often very, very dumb policies being applied. But again, it's incoherence rather than a specifically centrifugal force, because in some cases, these are people who think they're doing what the center wants. And again, we come back to this issue of communications of expectations. Everyone is guessing what the center wants, and sometimes they're going to guess right and sometimes they're going to guess wrong. But rather than just simply a clear articulation of some kind of grand vision, because Putin's got no grand vision, he's got nothing there to offer. It's not that he has a secret plan, but he's not telling anyone. It's that they are basically doing this from day to day, or often just not doing this from day to day, and therefore everyone is guessing.
So couldn't that lead to a disintegration within the center? I mean, because what you're describing, dysfunction, disintegration, difference of degree or difference of kind. But if that's the case, it is.
Eventually. Well, I mean, yeah, eventually it could lead that way. I mean, I think at the moment, though, we need to be aware that, as it were, there is a big difference between, as it were, institutions which cannot work, or institutions which could work but are not being used or not being used properly. At the moment, we're at the latter stage. Sure, let that continue, let things get worse, and things may well change. But I'm just talking about what I see at the moment around me.
Well, Paul, last word.
I think that dysfunction has a tendency to grow on itself unless somebody on top is able to articulate a vision and articulate a program and show a reason why dysfunction doesn't work for the people below as well. And force alone isn't going to do that. If one doesn't want to talk about 1991, And I think there are some arguments to be had about how effective certain institutions were that were being misused in the course of that year by President Gorbachev. I think one can look back in February of 1917 at a place where the center, where there was no directive coming down from the Tsar. The place was going in different places, and people finally said, if we want to win this war, that's why the February Revolution happened. And if you get to a point where people see their own government burning food when they don't have enough to eat, see the ruble dropping, the price of oil going south and going to continue to go south for the coming period, people are going to start asking questions. And it is precisely as it was in earlier times, the dysfunction and the coming apart of functions in the center that will spark these other things. Will it happen tomorrow? Not necessarily. Could it happen within the next months or years? Absolutely. And will it happen unexpectedly? Of course. And the reason is one that Russians cite all the time. A revolutionary situation occurs when those on top can't and those on the bottom won't put up with it anymore.
One has to wonder if Putin's going to come in with a Dizzy with Success speech at some point. And I guess on that note, we'll wrap it all up for today. That's all we have time for today. I would like to remind you, you have been listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name's Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. Joining me on the Skype line from Moscow has been co-host Mark Galeotti, a professor at New York University, an expert in Russian security services, and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. And also joining us via Skype from Staunton, Virginia, has been longtime Russia watcher Paul Goebel, author of the blog Window on Eurasia. Thank you for an enlightening discussion, gentlemen.
Thank you.
And I'd also like to thank our brilliant, patient, and ridiculously overworked producer, Tanya Konchova, and my indispensable and totally awesome colleague, Pavel Butorin, proprietor of the equally indispensable and totally awesome Twitter feed, Russia Police Watch, which you can and should follow at Rus Police Watch. I'd also like to remind you, you can subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You can read the Power Vertical blog and watch the Daily Vertical at rferl.org. And you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical. Join us again next week. And now, as always, I leave you with the ambient sounds of my favorite socially conscious Russian rapper, Noise MC.